This is Profiles in Risk. Hosted by Nick Lamparelli. Every week, we interview those who risk life, limb, fortunes, career, and reputation, and those who work behind the scenes who look to protect and enlighten us about risk. You can find the show notes and other insurance-related content at insnerds.com. That's insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Profiles in Risk. I am your host, Nick Lamparelli. In continuation of our series with my co-host, Wesley Todd. Wes, hello.
Good afternoon, Nick.
Very pleased to have our guest this week, John Ritchie. John is the Executive VP and Senior Operating Officer at American Integrity Insurance Company. American Integrity is the premier writer of Florida homeowners insurance. They have over 250,000 residential customers in the Sunshine State. If anyone can give us an idea of what it takes to stand up an insurance company, it's John. Wes, John, welcome.
Hey,
welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. I had to remember this time I recorded an entire podcast without my microphone in my face. It made for some massive echo, so I'll solve that one right away and get the audio just right. John, American Integrity, can you just kind of get us started with just a brief description of American Integrity and what your role is there?
Sure. So American Integrity, we are a Florida domestic property insurance company founded in 2006, starting to write 2007. Our only reason that we are around is because of the 2004 and 2005 hurricane seasons and the disruptive nature that those two consecutive seasons had on the state of Florida and the state of the property insurance market. Our founder and CEO, Bob, came down and started the company, and we started as a Citizens Depop company and quickly transitioned into a voluntary independent agent channel property writer. And as you mentioned, at this point now, we write about $300 million of gross written premium, about 280,000 policies just in Florida throughout the entire state.
Yep. And for those that are listening, to try to put this into context, 2004, 2005 were probably one of the worst back-to-back hurricane seasons. In 2004, Florida had four major hurricanes make landfall in the state. In 2005, Katrina skimmed through Florida on its way to devastating New Orleans. And then I believe Wilma was the other hurricane. So another massive hurricane that made landfall. So John, that's to me, the crux of insurance. You, American Integrity, Bob, you guys getting this thing stood up, were running towards risk. I call that buying low, right? While everyone else was running for the hills, trying to get out of Florida, you were actually going in. Can you talk about that environment, how difficult it is, like what it's like to try to start an insurance company when all of the major companies are leaving and you probably have a lot of reinsurers that have taken it on the chin and may not be necessarily interested in backing a new insurance company?
Sure, absolutely. So it's an interesting story, you know, after 04 and 05 to try to pitch a startup Florida-based property insurance company. it's not for the meek of heart. And we partnered up with Morgan Keegan Investment Bank, now part of Raymond James, and they did the proverbial pitch with roadshow meetings throughout the country for certain investor groups, and we stumbled onto Investor Capital that is still our primary investor capital out of Dallas, Texas, and we always joke saying that they were crazy enough to take the meeting as we were crazy enough to have the idea, and they've stuck with us along the way, and the contrarian play was something that they found very attractive. And, you know, for us, we saw the glut of capacity, and we knew that there was a market here that you could turn a profit and that you could make a mark if you put in the right type of business plan, if you had a long-term view of the marketplace and weren't a short-term player. And us, along with a number of great peer companies and competitor companies, came up because of that disruption as the national carriers, your State Farms and Allstates, and Nationwide's just exited the state for various reasons after two poor cat seasons in a row. That mixed in with reinsurance pricing going through the roof created truly a perfect storm for policies to dump back into the Florida insurer of last resort, Citizens Property Insurance. And there was a problem, and the state knew that. And the way that they could solve it was allow private insurance companies such as us to take out or depopulate one of the same in terms of vernacular and take those risks off the books, if you will, of the state onto private paper. And that really did allow us to get into business and get into the black, so to speak, out of the gate and scale the company pretty quickly in 2007 and then going into 2008.
So this really fits in well with kind of why we were having this podcast series, Nick, because the word innovation, you can't go 5 minutes without hearing it in the insurance industry today, right? And this was way before InsurTech was ever a thing. But it was still as innovative as it gets. So you're telling me that the opportunity really arose in 2004, 2005, and there was an insurance company up and running in 2007. Like that's, even in this day and age of so much technology, you don't even hear the InsurTechs being able to put together a platform with any business that soon. And so it fits along with a lot of the stuff we've been discussing, which is about really knowing the industry more than knowing technology or knowing innovation. And how important that is, and listening to people like John, people that have been there before, because if you were just saying, I want to start an insurance company, it would have failed if it wasn't for all the market dynamics that were in play, right? That were in play that set this up. You know, you were as in tune with the industry, which I have a million questions about it, how you figured that out so fast. But you were in tune with the industry and the opportunity, and that is what really created the opportunity. After that, it was build a great business. But at the time, it was, and so that to me is the ultimate innovation. And so when I think of, you know, I see all this innovation going on, I just think back to something like that where, you know, Nick was saying it's a market need. And so I just think it's just it's a really big takeaway why we did this pod is just really thinking about, instead of just looking at your product or looking at your own perspective, you're not going to go anywhere if you're not looking at this market as a whole or some piece of the market you're trying to fix.
Yeah. So, John, would it have been possible for you to execute on that vision if, let's say, you couldn't depopulate Citizens? Would the business have worked?
The model would not have held. Sure, you could have gotten into the market through M&A. That's always an option. That's quite often an expensive option. You could argue post 2004, 2005, it may not have been quite as expensive, but really the ability of those two, or the circumstances of those two seasons mixed in with the outcome of Citizens ballooning in size. And one other point, after 2004, 2005, Poe had just gone under, a large insurance company here in Florida. So you mix in national carriers running out, Poe going under, all that dumping into Citizens after two storm seasons. It really was, I guess, pun intended, a perfect storm for a startup to jump in because of the market dynamics and that paradigm shift of the Florida marketplace. Because the last time that had happened was 93 rather, post Andrew in 1992. So it's all about finding those points, finding those moments where the circumstances and the variables are aligned to allow for someone to jump in and scale a company and disrupt a marketplace. Not necessarily that we were doing anything innovative in the word that you would consider, you know, the insurtech space today, but for your blocking, tackling, brick and mortar, you know, insurance company at that point, given what we were doing, it was different than Nationwide Insurance, generally speaking.
Would it be possible to start? How difficult would it be to start an insurance company in Florida like you did today?
Wow.
It would be a challenge. It would be a challenge only because of the opportunity to scale quickly out of Citizens is no longer there. To put some relative perspective on this, when we first started the company, Citizens had about 1.5 million policies in their personal lines account. Today, that number last I checked, is a little under 400,000. And that's a result of multiple years in a row over the last decade of other carriers, ourself included up until about 5 years ago, continuing to depopulate citizens. So that channel is exhausted. The M&A channel, and that's another channel that you could use, and some folks have done this to get into business. It is much more expensive today, in my opinion, than it was even after 04 and 05. Valuations are still lofty in spite of, market conditions that arguably are the most challenging for the Florida marketplace. We tell our employees and our agents and our reinsurance partners and our capital providers that this moment right now for the Florida marketplace is the most challenging since 1992 with Hurricane Andrew. And it's not natural based. It's in a lot of ways it's man-made with the lack of legislative reform for multiple years in a row, and the general state of litigation and the litigious nature of the state of Florida. It truly is a hard place to turn a profit, and the year-end 18 results speak to that for the Florida domestics.
I think it goes back to exactly what you just said about, you know, looking at them going where everybody else is leaving. And I'm just wondering, I'm wondering two things. One is, how did you even know, or how did the people, you know, your team that started, how did you even know that this opportunity existed? You know, where's the tangible advice maybe for the listeners? And I'm just thinking of like other examples, like, you know, Nick, obviously, you know, I think, you know, your company might be an example. Trying to think, I mean, workers' comp in Florida, workers' comp across the country. I'm just trying to think of
I mean, doesn't that happen all the time? I remember having, I remember driving with an underwriter in California, and I remember him looking at me and saying, man, if we had only just written earthquake coverage after Northridge, we would have had 20 plus years of no losses. And you hear this all the time. It's always like the best time to start writing is when the market hardens. People are afraid to do it. And it's probably the same problem, like for, you know, when the stock market crashes, everyone's afraid that it's going to keep crashing, but that's actually the best time to jump in, you know?
It is. I think, you know, the person who does it the best is Warren Buffett. What he has done in terms of running into a burning building, so to speak, when everyone is working out, you know, how he all but saved Lloyd's with their asbestos claim issue a number of years ago, what he did post-financial crisis, bailing out in a lot of ways, a lot of big banks by buying their paper. It is having the fortitude to see that it's a temporary glitch of the market dynamics, which creates the opportunity to jump in and build something because of it.
Yeah,
I think the whole market, I mean, you know, personal lines auto, personal lines home across the country, I think is, it can be considered undervalued to some extent, right? I mean, because there's this threat on the auto carriers that there's going to be autonomous vehicles. And so what's the multiple on a company that may not be around in 10 years? And then, you know, with home, I think people just don't value like how long people stay with their carrier, you know, and there's no multiples on that. It's just, it's interesting because it, maybe the whole insurance market is actually an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look at some of the new startups. I mean, the easiest one to take a look at is Lemonade and some of the peer companies like Lemonade and some of the disruption that they're trying to enact and push through. And of course, you know, early financial results are not going to be favorable for a new company, but model, you know, you can say, maybe that makes some sense. I think what's different about Florida, jumping around here a little bit from a Lemonade model, is the independent agent channel is very much alive and well, just given capacity constraints, given the pricing dynamics of Florida residential property insurance. So the individual, the end consumer, values the relationship that they have with their independent agent. And, you know, to be frank, the lack of national carriers writing significantly in Florida diminishes the bundling, if you will, that you see outside of Florida with their auto, with their home, and everything else.
Yeah. Can we go back to the period where you opened the doors? What was that like? as the first policies are beginning to roll in, I'm assuming, just because you don't have the law of large numbers, that your financial situation is probably very similar to what we see with a Lemonade or a Hippo, where you got lucky. There weren't any major events, but you still have fires and other claims that are still occurring. I think Florida is one of the top lightning states and one of the top tornado states. So you still have those things happening. What were the financial pressures like that first year or two as you're trying to get your footing?
Yeah, one of the best stories that I can offer that illustrates that is we founded the company with $10 million of seed capital to get the company off the ground, given statutory requirements. And after our first depopulation from Citizens, where immediately you go to bed, so to speak, and the next morning we have 100,000 customers that are now American Integrity customers. A number of days later, I'm going to get the number wrong, but it may have been no more than 3 weeks after we depopulated Citizens, we had our first major fire loss. And it was, I believe, a $600,000 or $700,000 total fire. So out of the gate, we've just lost 6 or 7% of capital on one claim. That took a little bit of a gulp and you recognize exactly and recognize that, hey, it's still insurance. Frequency and severity will still play. It just so happened that severity got in front of frequency, I guess, in this one instance. But no, the first couple of years are challenging for any startup company. And you're trying to build and grow and maintain capital. You're trying to recruit people that will come work for you and buy into your story and convince them that you're viable and that, you know, them quitting whatever job that they have that's secure with, you know, certainly a larger company than we are, that's a tough challenge. And Wes, you've lived this life starting Case Glide, and Nick, you have as well. And it's all about trying. You're always selling. You're constantly selling, whether it's to an agent, why they should sell your product, whether it's to an investor group, whether it's to an employee, whether it's to anyone. And I don't think that ever fully stops either. I think even as you scale and you get to become a larger organization and entity, you need to hold on to that scrappiness of always knowing that it can fall out from underneath you as quickly as it was built. And you don't want to live paranoid, but a little paranoia doesn't hurt either.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to explore that a little bit more. You specifically the talent challenge that we were talking about before we started recording, and now you just brought it up again. And start with your background. You weren't in insurance. You graduated from college. You were in finance. You even have an entrepreneurial background as well. Can you talk about two things? One is what ultimately attracted you to insurance, but also how did those other skill sets help you when you finally got here?
Sure. So I'll take the inverse order of that. So my background, as you mentioned, was finance. I had a small startup completely outside of the insurance space. I grew up in Chicago, and it was a small entrepreneurial venture, which was off-campus collegiate textbook retailing of all things. And it was a time where that model still made sense and you could sell. And it was starting to be disrupted by Amazon. And really, that was my first taste personally of recognizing that disruption is continuous. And anytime that you think that you have it right and stable, it will get turned upside down. And just trying to stay ahead is vital. But to answer the first part of your question, I stumbled into insurance, to be quite honest. And in a lot of ways, I probably fought against insurance. There's a family background of insurance for me. Both my grandfather and father are in this industry, and I never thought that I would end up here. But it so happened that the more I learned, the more I read, to be quite honest, I referenced him earlier, Warren Buffett, his annual statements and annual reports are just fascinating if you want to learn about property insurance or insurance in general, because the man has a way to explain complicated topics in such a simple way. It's truly remarkable how he can explain it. And I fell in love with the industry, and I fell in love with the idea of taking risk smashing it all together and creating a book that could actually turn a profit and it could actually function. And that that was fascinating for me. So the opportunity presented itself to join up here with the American Integrity Group, and it was quite frankly the best decision I ever made. I love this space.
So I have a question on that. I know you want to go the talent route, but I think we're going to go there in a second. Before we do that, though, without getting yourself in trouble, if you know today John Ritchie could talk to, you know, beginning of American Integrity, John Ritchie, and you know some options or things like you know all these things that you've done for clients or for the brokers, for your employees. You know, I've watched it happen over the years, change all the, you know, different get-togethers you have and the culture here, and I've seen that evolve. Also, talent-wise, I've seen the executive management web part of the website, you know, grow and grow and grow. What does today's John Ritchie say to, you know, startup American Integrity John Ritchie for a little, you know, hints of advice about starting in this business? And another option might be go bigger. I mean, you know, maybe you wanted 100 million, maybe you have the whole market. I don't know. Just interesting to think about those things. I don't want to answer it myself, though.
No. You know, the biggest thing is just for me, it's be patient. Spend the appropriate amount of time at the level that you're at. Ambition is a wonderful thing, but also, you know, sharpening your blade along the way is critical because those are the foundational skill sets that will pay dividends down the road. Is, you know, you're presented with different and in some ways larger challenges, but just enjoy, I guess, enjoy the ride.
Yeah, I think that's important advice for everybody. Be patient. That's a good one. You weren't very patient, though.
No, I was not patient.
That's sort of the advice that I give, and I think a lot of younger people lack that because there could be financial pressures or something else that kind of necessitates it. But looking back, it's
sure.
I talked about this on other podcasts. Every time I chased the money, I regretted it. You know, I didn't have the patience to kind of stick through it. And I think that is an appropriate lesson, like learning when you should struggle, learning when you should continue to struggle, learning when you should stick around somewhere, get more experience before you take that leap and try to do something before you're ready, I think is probably extremely valuable advice.
Yeah, I mean, you have to live right too to be able to do that. You have to live below your means at these ages, right? Because you can't take any risks, or you have to, you know, just get very lucky and very fortunate and jump into a business that goes gangbusters from the beginning, which is very rare.
If you're betting on luck, that's a hard bet to take. Yeah.
John, how can we? Well, what does American Integrity do to try to attract younger talent, and what can we as an industry do to try to get the young John Ritchie, instead of going into finance, to, you know, be less patient and come into insurance faster?
Right. Now, for us here at American Integrity, it all comes down to culture. It's the type of team and the type of environment that you build. And that sounds easy, but I can tell you that quite honestly, the hardest job for any person, and certainly any person in a leadership and management capacity, is to build a culture that allows for the individual to grow and succeed while also maintaining that the organization is heading in the right direction. So for us, it's keeping that entrepreneurial feel of a startup. Maybe not necessarily the fire, you know, putting out fires on a daily basis type feel, but that hustle, if you will, of keeping a fast paced work environment, but also encouraging fun within the workplace, encouraging teamwork. And I'm speaking to some of our core values here at the company that we actually explicitly state. And the one that stands out to me the most, for me personally, and for our organization, is humility. Recognizing that you don't have all the answers, recognizing that around the table, any idea can come from any person, regardless of title or position within the organization. And that's something that for us, we've tried to instill throughout American Integrity through formalized training. We utilize the John Maxwell executive and corporate coaching platform to offer that training to our team. And the big thing that John teaches is that leadership is nothing more than influence. And anyone can influence from anywhere within the organization, regardless of where you're at. So for us, that's the DNA of our culture. And a culture is always ever changing. It's never complete. It changes with new people around the table, so to speak. It changes with different demographics in terms of age of team members that you're recruiting for. So looping back to your question, for us, we are active at universities here throughout the state of Florida and even outside of the state of Florida to try to encourage and explain why an insurance career is a great career path, because within the world of financial services, I think insurance is often dwarfed behind banking and other facets. And, you know, within this space, it's a wonderful career. And we were talking before we started filming here that even within the space of insurance, there are certain industries that are truly needing great talent. And one that comes to mind is claims. There was, quite frankly, in Hurricane Irma 2 years ago, and then even Michael to a lesser extent last year in 18, proved that there is truly a need for claims professionals. And if you know, in my mind, are a smart, capable, energetic, enthusiastic, but most importantly, curious person, claims is a great road, and you can make a difference for yourself and for the industry.
And you can make a lot of money because, you know, the what I think a lot of people are missing out on, you got people going to law school, finishing, you know, halfway through their class, getting a job at the public defender for $45,000. They could be at an insurance company making $100,000, you know, not too long, working claims, because their ROI, the value that they bring to it, you know, they'll handle $500,000 to $700,000 to $1 million worth of claims a year. And if they can, basically do, you know, 20% better than average, that means that they're paying for themselves times two. So we're very lucky to have companies like American Integrity here in town. But I mean, I don't know how you do it. I mean, insurance nerds is we need insurance nerds and in a flyer on every college student's doorstep, because it can be very cool. It can be very lucrative. I mean, the people here that work here love it. The ones that I deal with, they absolutely love it. They've been here a long time, or they wish they had been here a long time. But yeah, I think claims is very interesting. I'm not as familiar with the other departments about the talent level, but I know for a fact, I mean, if you, like you said, are smart, energetic, thoughtful, I mean, you'll be in six figures in no time. I have a friend, you know, he didn't have a job until he was 28. I don't know what he was doing, but he got working for a TPA and, you know, got started about a year before Irma. Now this guy's just obsessed and he's doing well. He's obsessed with insurance. He's doing so well. And that could be the story for probably 1,000 people just in Florida alone this year, if they wanted to rewrite their story.
Well, that message. I think the interesting thing about claims, by the way, 2019 is the year of claims for insurance nerds. We want to make, a big inroad in there and try to get claims more exposed so that people can hear about all the different things that you can do there. I think one of the most important things, besides the difference that you make, and my friend John Bachman, you know, his story is his big first claim was an auto accident when someone died. And he was a difference maker to that family, you know, so it was a big deal. So beyond that, which I think is really important when you can put your arm around someone, if you develop an expertise in claims, there are no limitations in terms of areas you can go into at other insurance companies. I'd like to get John's feedback on that. I mean, if you're a claims expert, you can provide positive insight into underwriting, into product development, into finance. There's like a lot of different areas because you're there on the front lines. You're seeing what's not getting paid, where the customer conflicts are arising, where the potential opportunities might be presenting themselves.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You know, a claims professional sees the product that was built by our product department, that was sold by our claim or our sales and marketing department, underwritten by our underwriting department, of course, and adjudicated by the, that person and their department. So they truly are seeing the, you know, the full gauntlet, if you will, of what was built and marketed and sold. And I think one aspect of any person coming into this industry is if you're data centric, if you know how to use, manipulate, and make informed decisions based upon data and insights because of data, that's just going to give you a leg advantage above anyone else. And to be quite frank, you know, all the talent that we see that are entry level coming out of college, that's just ingrained in their DNA at this point. That's how they were brought up. And, you know, the generation that they're coming into is very much of that mindset. And, you know, going back to your original question, yes, if you're a claims professional, you can easily drop back into different parts of an organization within an insurance company and be very effective. And we've seen that here at American Integrity, where a claims adjuster, I can think of one in particular, just recently transitioned to underwriting as an underwriter for us. And it's a wonderful transition because that individual knows what they saw in the claim department when they held and dealt with those types of issues. Yep. And the pending that they manage. So it just helps them even more from an underwriting perspective.
Yeah, completely. Transitioning to technology. So you've had this experience with the startup in, you know, post 2004, 2005 era. Can you talk about the type of technology it took to get the operation started then versus what American Integrity looks like now if someone were to go down to your server room?
Yeah, great question. You know, the heart and soul of any insurance company is your IT back room and the platform that you sell, underwrite, and service, you know, your policies on. For us, we managed to find a really great partner out of the gate that helped us get into business in terms of, you know, scrappy, you know, quick technology. You know, again, going back to that point that I made earlier in this conversation, that we went to bed one night with no policies in force and we woke up the next day with 100,000. That doesn't happen overnight to service that. And
Were they all PDF files?
Exactly.
You know, they could have been, right?
They could have been, sure. We were lucky enough that we found an IT partner that was able to build a platform for us to service that and deal with any claim issues. That one in particular that I mentioned a couple of weeks after we got into business. So, of course, that's the core of it. And then everything else, we were using outsourced IT vendors, just anything and everything to bootstrap and rubber band and, you know, band-aid together a company that can function from email to, you know, storage to servicing and processing. At that point, we didn't have a server room to speak of. We had nothing in-house. And today, on the other hand, it's much different for us. While we don't have anything physically on-house or in-house here in off-prem facilities, we have a lot of racks. We have redundancy racks to make sure that we can service our customers. Everything, of course, for the most part, is moving into a cloud-based platform in our back room. We've transitioned to a new vendor in the last couple of years, and everything that we utilize to service and manage our business is in the cloud, so to speak. That's a interesting word. You know, where is the cloud? What is the cloud? But then on the flip side, it's a lot of heavy analytics, it's a lot of modeling, it's a lot of software as a service, going back to a cloud-based service provider. And for us, it's a much different world. And we've learned along the way, too. We thought at one point, this is going back 5 or 6 years ago, boy, it's a great idea. Let's host our own exchange environment for email. That was a horrible idea. you know, when email goes down and you can only look at yourself and you're trying to figure out how to fix that, that was a pain point that we found people who were much better and competent than us to manage. So learning along the way of what makes sense to house, what makes sense to partner with, what makes sense to build versus buy. You know, for us, we always view it as, is it within our core competency? Do we have the in-house technical talent to do this. If we don't, let's not pretend we are what we aren't, and let's find smart, bright people who we can partner with. Wes, again, with CaseFlight is a great example, to buy something that smart people built.
So,
Wes, I want to pick that up with you, because that has to be an important pitch on your end. And I'll give you a weekend experience that I had. I went to a St. Patrick's Day dinner and brought my kids. My kids playing with this thing. It's got light switches and locks and zippers and stuff. And I was talking to the host and he was like, oh, I saw this on Amazon for $160. And I said, I can make that. And he said, by the time he was done, it was like $300 that he did it. And that is my experience with companies that step outside of their core competencies, is it always takes longer. No doubt, always takes longer. With time is money. But it's almost always more expensive as well. And then they always forget the maintenance costs, you know, how difficult it is to maintain that technology over time, you know, because people like you that make software, you're constantly updating software and analytics and stuff like that. Can you talk about that?
Well, this is the discussion, right? And I'm so glad John brought it up. Build versus buy. And you know, what is it in order, right? It's probably a modeling tool. It's a pricing tool. It's a policy management tool. Then it's a claim system. I mean, those are the things you need. And so, yeah, that's core to your business. Do you have to buy it? I mean, no, but in that order is the ones you look at for what are priorities to build. And should it be worth it? I mean, it probably should be worth it. And you know, to build it, because that's going to be your differentiator. It's just it's so interesting how much this sets back companies. I haven't seen it happen here, you know, thank God. But I've seen some companies where they're going to do a claim system implementation, and so they'll have this really bad litigation issue where they're getting adverse loss. But they have a claim system implementation, so 2014 passes, and maybe we can't look at a litigation software. We got to wait till everybody's tied up. 2015 passes, 2016 passes, and then all of a sudden, I've seen it happen. The company's on the edge of going out of business, and their stock drops in half. And we talked to them in 2014, and they could have just plugged and played. 2 weeks later, they could have been up and running. So it's like and you know what? There are certain situations where I would say I don't blame them, because there's so much crap out there and there's so much noise that where do you begin? So it is the ultimate challenge, and there needs to be it's impossible for John and his part-time job to go out there and find which solutions are snake oil and which solutions are the real deal. But that is the function, maybe one of the primary functions of an insurance company today, is to be able to make those decisions effectively, because there are a lot of good solutions out there. But picking the wrong one can set you back forever.
Sure.
So, John, talk about how you make decisions. What is American Integrity's process and criteria as you're evaluating new technology? And I mean technology, be not just hardware, software, but analytics, data, modeling, you know, all of these solutions. What's on your checklist as you're thinking through a pitch from someone that's trying to help you?
Right. No, good question. And certainly right now, to piggyback a little bit on what Wes was saying, the InsurTech space is so crowded, and there are so many competing products doing virtually pretty close to the same thing. You know, we get calls and we get pitches here on a regular basis for certain pieces of technology that can do a lot. And certainly they look slick. The demo looks fantastic. And, you know, the sales professional does a great job explaining the product. And we start to see where we could add, that could add value to us, whether it's from an underwriting loss or an underwriting selection criteria, or from a loss severity mitigation tool. But ultimately it comes down to, you know, does it make sense to plug in? And if it does, great. And then a cost. Cost is always going to be the driver. You know, can that fit into the insurance dollar? There's only 100 cents in the insurance dollar, of course. And can we afford to purchase that? But I got a little off track, but to answer your question about how do we select technology, often we've done this. We hire someone to help us that knows the space. They know the market players. For instance, when we were converting from our core platform, from our legacy provider that got us into business to our current provider, we hired, in our opinion, my opinion, you know, a pro that can come in that knows the landscape. And it's more than just looking at the quadrants of where, you know, different technologies, you know, lie, and figuring out who's the right partner for us. And partner is a key word too, because I hate the word vendor. It's not a vendor, it's a partner. And a partnership means that they will continue to work with you. They will continue to develop their product and their technology. They understand what we're trying to do here at American Integrity. And they try to at least meet us halfway of offering a product that meets the solution or for the outcome that we're trying to achieve. So, you know, long-winded response, but it's either we know the technology space well enough, whether, you know, CAT modeling is a great example. We know the players there and we license the majority of them in-house. That's an easy one for us. That's our bread and butter of risk selection. Telephony, you know, for us, we have gone through a couple telephony replacements. I couldn't tell you one good telephony provider or technology vendor over another. That's where bringing in someone who knows that space is beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you touched on something that, again, Wes, it goes back to our original conversation in December. For every dollar of freemium, you've accounted for that entire dollar pretty much. And so I think one of the weaknesses of a lot of the insurtechs that I keep harping on is their inability to sell, that they don't understand that coming in and just pitching a lower loss ratio for you is not adequate. Because they need to be able to say, okay, well, here's your dollar of premium, and here's how we expect if you implement us, that dollar of premium would rearrange all its cents in, you know, how we're going to like rearrange that for you, and this is how we would fit in. I think that's a big one, right? They come in and they beyond the partnership, I think the partnership's huge, but they can't communicate the partnership because they're not speaking your language. All they're telling you is, hey, if you use our thing, you'll have lower losses, but your business is a lot more than that.
Yep.
Well, this goes along with two themes, actually. Two. Number one was, you know, understanding the industry, not your product. So understanding the industry and understanding that in order to carve out part of that premium, you have to carve out whatever, some other expense to make it happen, number one. And then number two, so that was a big theme that we were talking about as insurance industry insiders, innovating from within, all those type of things. The second one was people first, technology second. You heard John when he answered the question about technology, he said he brings in people that know it. So that, you know, that's the lead domino. And that's what Nick and I were talking about when we started this podcast is people first, technology second. It's really the people that are involved, the technology by itself. It's been proven countless times it's going to do absolutely nothing. It's the people operating that technology, the vision, the higher vision from you, the vision right beneath you with your, you know, supervisor in that department. But, you know, those two things, you know, building it from within and then focusing on the people over the technology, those are recipes for success that I think are getting lost way too frequently in this discussion.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And, you know, and one thing as well is, you know, of course, cost and functionality. You can't, and going back to people, you can't diminish, and frankly, it's the most important thing for me, is go live risk. What is the probability that this just languishes and you're in implementation mode for a year, 2 years, 3 years? We all have seen known projects that just continue to live out into purgatory, and you just keep throwing good money after a project that may never get off the ground, and the technology may be the best in the world and it will diminish your loss ratio in half, but if you can't get it live, it's useless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big one. So I'm gonna steal your thunder, Nick. I know you want to ask this. I bet I could just see it stewing in your mind, but so you have drones, you have pricing.
That was my next question.
Got him. Hey, it's the, you know, you get to do these all the time. I only get to do them every so often. Yeah. So.
Go ahead. I teed it up for you.
Yeah. So you have drones, you have, you know, maybe better agency facing tools, you know, quicker pricing. You have the virtual adjusting opportunities, you know, with being able to, you know, adjust the claim on your phone. Am I leaving any out? I mean, those are things I think are
blockchain. Possible. I mean,
blockchain.
There's all of these new technologies that didn't exist, frankly, just a few years ago. And now they're all here, all knocking on your doorstep, all promising to lower your loss ratio, lower your claims handling expense, streamline this and that. How do you juggle all that?
Yeah, you know, we've looked at a lot. We've implemented a few, frankly, just a couple, because of trying to be deliberate and cautious and patient. Going back to that word, and how we select technology. It's interesting, because I agree, you know, loss control is certainly front and center in a lot of the InsurTech offerings that they push out. You know, and then there's also niche risk selection. How can you find that crease that others are looking past that what does make sense? Of course, it all goes back to loss ratio, but those two pieces are interesting to us. For us, we're on the front end, the best data that we can possibly get our hands on, whether it's roof permit data, whether it's permit data for plumbing systems, whether it's shape of roof, age of construction, all of those types of variables that play into the risk characteristics that ultimately decide whether or not we want to buy that piece of business. That's mightily important. On the back end, you touched on a couple. I think what's really interesting is some of the virtual loss assessing tools. Those are interesting in controlling loss adjustment expenses and how much it costs to actually service that claim. In Florida, I'm somewhat cautious on that, given the litigious environment that we currently face, is to make sure this for our space. The biggest question is, are we putting a tool into play that looks great but will cause problems downstream? And is it something that will end up costing us more post-loss than the benefit pre-loss? Those are the big criteria that we always look at. Drones, yeah, they get a lot of play. We use drones a little bit during Irma. I think it's interesting. I think for, you know, some of our peer companies have built that into their claim handling practice, and I think that it can be utilized. I think for the large national insurance carriers, that makes a lot of sense. They can build teams that can scale and actually deploy them in meaningful fashion. For a CAT event, for a hurricane event, for us, that's interesting. Aerial imagery is great to get an image, real-time image of the roof, to see if there is damage, is there a tree on top of the roof, so on and so forth. So all of those are interesting. A lot of them we use for one-off purposes for hurricane events, post-event. Some we've implemented into our core platform for underwriting, and some we're looking at to plug in for claims handling for our attritional non-cat losses.
How do you think your technology performed during Irma or Michael?
Yeah, good question. So, InsurTech, you think of some of the more recent, you know, firms that have come up and have started, you know, to try to offer a product. But, you know, there's a lot of legacy in InsurTech, and I'll use that term loosely because I think it is. I mean, Verisk, the offering of products that they have, AIR, RMS, Karen Clark's modeling tools, those are InsurTech. It's all about technology with data to try to make better decisions. So for Michael, Irma is more interesting because Irma, we were able to toy around and play with some different technologies that we wouldn't normally, just because the resource constraints that storm created forced carriers, ourselves included, to get creative and to try different things to try to adjust a claim. So for us, that was our first usage of drones, was Irma. We didn't use them significantly, but we used them in certain parts and for certain types of claims that made sense. Aerial imagery to get views of the roof line were vitally important for us for Irma. So by and large, you know, if we would have had to have relied upon 100% boots on the ground inspectors with no other tools, it would have been a challenge, because the biggest tool for us is Xactimate sketching a loss and utilizing that to determine the ultimate severity of the claim. So yep. You know, those tools are just mightily important. Some of them have been around with us for a number of years and decades. Some are newer, but the culmination and then sort of all of those together allowed us to handle, you know, for American Integrity, 30 some odd thousand Hurricane Irma claims. And Michael was more of a compact, condensed, isolated event, but still it was severe. But the number of claims weren't there. But Irma really is a good example of one that required thinking outside of the box from a claim adjudication perspective.
So again, it wasn't really about the technology, it was about the opportunity, yep. Right? And the need. It's fascinating. I think that we would do well, and I don't really know, you know, you have Nick's podcast where I've learned a lot of different things from Kazil interview, MGA, you know, MGA founders, InsurTech founders, data, you know, centric companies, and then you have, I think, a few other research, but I just don't know a lot of other resources to get information out. You know, we know it because a lot of our clients, you know, in the Southeast, things like that, but I just wonder what the tools might be, because it does, the common theme seems to be that it's really about finding the opportunity more so than finding the technology and bringing that technology to them.
And, you know, piecing together pieces of technology. So one thing, as you were talking, Wes, is with Michael, we were able to piece together, NOAA produced pretty quickly real-time satellite imagery for post-Hurricane Michael. So dumping that into some in-house built analytics tools allowed us to offer our adjusters, you could just type in an address and get a real-time view of the roof and the risk, and then a view of what it was beforehand. And you know, for a part of the panhandle, Mexico Beach is the best example. Our ability to see, no, the home is physically just no longer there. That's yeah. We can start that claim process that much quicker for the customer.
You can direct pay them too, right? You're one of the few Florida companies that have that. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on there.
Can you quickly describe direct pay?
So a couple of things that we've done. We have debit cards for ALE that we offer to our customers,
really cool.
It allows them to go and get the hotel room, get food for their kids and themselves, get clothes, and you know, start to rebuild their life, you know, as best as possible, so that they can, you know, get back on their feet, you know. And then, of course, the biggest challenge, and I'm going somewhat off track here, but the biggest challenge with Michael and Irma to a lesser extent has been just not really adjusting and getting settlement. It's contractors. It's getting the actual folks on the ground that can rebuild the home. That's the pain point right now for a lot of people in the panhandle. And that's a problem that I think, you know, the insurance industry possibly can solve in conjunction with the construction industry. But it is certainly a problem for these types of events that are, you know, even moderate frequency, but high in severity.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
This has been an awesome conversation. What is the state of the Florida insurance market, and what are the plans for American Integrity?
The loaded question. The state of the Florida insurance market is, as I mentioned earlier, this is the most challenging operating environment we have seen since Hurricane Andrew. Reform is drastically needed. As we were talking here on March 19th, our elected officials in Tallahassee are in the general session. There is hope that reform is coming in some sort or another, but you can't build a business model or a annual plan around hope and prayers. For us, it's blocking, tackling, partnering with better in class, if not best in class agents, which we believe that our agents are the best in class agents in the state of Florida. They are the frontline underwriter. They will give you the type of business that is either good, fair, or great, or bad. And that's mightily important in picking your spots and figuring out, you know, the risk characteristics that meet, you know, your risk tolerance. So for us, that's our approach as we go into this year in 2019. Of course, we hope for reform, but absent that, we'll continue operating as we have. For us, American Integrity will continue to grow as a Florida-only domestic insurance company, proudly so. And our business model continues to be in the independent agent channel, and that'll continue.
Fantastic. I learned a lot. You know, I always think I have a pulse on, hey, to start an insurance company kind of feels like this, but I actually learned quite a bit. I hope the audience did as well. So, John, thank you so much for sharing part of your day with us to talk about Florida insurance market, American Integrity, your career, your background, the talent gap. We touched on a lot of subjects, technology, drones. We touched on a lot. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. So yeah. For Wes, you got any parting words?
I was just saying that was action packed. You're right. I mean, that was a lot we covered, but I think that, you know, this just goes back to the thing we have to have more people like John talking to the people in the industry. We really need to understand the problems in the industry. There's a lot of smart people out there, and if we communicate just a little bit better instead of kind of trying to blast our messaging onto everybody, I think a lot can get done, and we need to act soon. So I really appreciate all the insights you provided. And, of course, Nick, I always love the questions. So fantastic pod, as always.
Thank you. Thank you. From my co-host, Wesley Todd, John Ritchie, thank you so much for joining again.